All right, so I thought I would start, since you people are all supposed to have read now chunks of the source material for Jewish law, with the things that you struck you that were interesting or that you couldn't understand or wanted to discuss or whatever. And if we run out of those things before the class runs out, I've got a bunch of my notes, which are all from one of the three volumes that I spent a good deal of time the last 3 days going through, and again found Maimonides quite a lot of fun, interested in various weird ways. For example, how many of you realize that according to Maimonides, partial birth abortion is wrong? All right, this was a hot issue like 4 or 5 years ago about abortion when the baby has sort of started being born. He covers it. That according to Maimonides, ordinary abortion to save the life of the mother is all right. Why is it all right? Did anybody read that bit? Because that was sort of fun. It's all right because if you see somebody pursuing someone else trying to kill him, you are entitled to stop him even if the only way of stopping him is to kill the pursuer. All right. You should stop the pursuer without killing him if you can. But you're entitled to kill him if necessary, and even if it's not necessary, if you kill him when you could have just injured him, you're guilty in the eyes of God but not in the eyes of the court. So, well, Maimonides says the fetus that is killing the mother is analogous to, is equivalent to, the person who's trying to kill someone. So if the only way of keeping the fetus from killing the mother is to kill the fetus, you're entitled to do so. And then I don't think he ever makes it really clear why that rule disappears when the fetus begins to emerge, but he does say so, and it may just be he's got some source. I mean, my mind, he doesn't get to make up his answers. He's got to get them largely from Mishnah and just clarify things. But I thought that was sort of interesting just because it was a hot issue not very long ago, and here it was apparently an issue at least in the 12th century, and if it's in Mishnah, I didn't check whether it was in Mishnah, but if it is, that pushes it 1,000 years farther back still, which is sort of neat. All right, so what things struck people in what they read in Maimonides, Mishnah, and or Talmud over the last few days? Anyone? Yes?
So I ran into a case that was analogous to the famous property law case of Pearson v. Post. And it said, if a man sees someone running after a lost article, like an injured deer or pigeons that are so young they can't fly away, then the landowner can say, my field acquires possession for me, and it works. But if they're not injured deer and if the pigeons can fly away, then simply say, my land owns these animals, doesn't work. The animals are wild, they can run off. You don't have possession.
Yes. There are a whole bunch of rules that relate in various ways. For example, you're not supposed to grab doves because the presumption is that they're in somebody's dovecot and will go back. And I think there are things you can't do unless you're some distance away from settled areas. The question is, can you assume a pigeon is wild or not, or is property? And if I remember correctly, there is a rule about the land acquiring ownership for you, which applies to the land you're standing in for a very small distance around you. So,
4 cubits.
Yes, that's right.
And it varied if you were an unmarried woman.
That I didn't remember. That's interesting. Yes, I should say, by the way, on the question of unmarried women, this business about it's all right to kill somebody to stop them from committing murder. It's also all right to kill somebody to stop him from committing rape against a betrothed maiden. But the implication is that killing him is excessive if it's an unbetrothed maiden. Or else it may just be that the Bible happens to mention the betrothed maiden. But I thought, again, it was sort of striking that was a distinction that occurred to whoever was it, whether Maimonides or Mishnah, the author of Mishnah, or maybe the author of the Old Testament, between betrothed and unbetrothed maidens are in different categories, apparently. So that was one of the things you see in life, you may have noticed a good deal, is this whole question of, does this occur on your property, on someone else's property, in the public road, so that, did anybody notice, what are the rules on killing thieves? All right, you know, in Texas, this is sort of, again, it's occasionally a politically argued issue, can you use lethal force to defend your home? And in some states, I think the basic rule is the only time you can kill a burglar is if you couldn't run away and you're afraid of being killed. I think everyone agrees that you can kill in self-defense to protect your life. I believe states disagree on whether you can kill to protect your property, or even whether you can kill to protect your life if you have the alternative of running away.
Yeah, the argument of duty of retreat, and you don't, in no state, you have a duty to retreat from your own home. In other words, if an armed burglar enters in your home, you have the right to kill.
Even if you're even
in the story. The problem is, if you're outside your home, if you're just in property, and you could have retreated to your home, some states say you don't have a duty to retreat. Other states,
or then I'm wrong. So there's,
you're in your home. You have
there's no state. That's interesting. Then I was wrong. I thought you did. Part of what reason interested me was something that happened to me, which is sort of interesting. But long, long time ago, I was living in Philadelphia in a not terribly good neighborhood, and I and my then wife were witnesses to a shooting. And the result was that we ended up spending a notable amount of time talking with police, and I think my wife ended up testifying. I don't think I ever testified. And I had an interesting conversation with a policeman who was giving me some advice. And his advice was that if there's a burglar and you shoot him, there are two things you should make sure of. One of them is that his body ends up inside your house, and the other is that he's dead. I thought that was fascinating because, I mean, it may well be good advice, but here you have a policeman telling me to commit a felony, and perjury, presumably. And, you know, that fit my general impression. I don't know if it's still true or may depend place to place. The police are no more law-abiding than anybody else. That, you know, this guy was well-intentioned, but he thought that the legal system in which I could get into trouble for the perfectly natural act of shooting a burglar, even when he was running away, maybe, was a bad one, and so he wanted to tell me how to avoid getting caught by it. Now, Maimonides discussed, did anybody read that bit of Maimonides?
I just wanted to make a comment. My uncle was a police detective in Boston, and I think you, from the standpoint of economics, would understand that what the police always see it as is tightening the case to make it as efficient as possible to get through the system.
That's interesting.
That's their rationale.
So you think he wasn't trying to help me particularly, he was trying to make sure that there wouldn't be complications if I ever did it.
He may have been helping you, but he had the motive in general is to get that case. They want to get the case through the system as fast as possible with the least amount of resistance.
Right.
And that's the way to do it. So they tighten the case that way.
Yes, well, of course.
Some cops will do that themselves. They'll move the body.
Yes.
Or change the position of the body. They make sure the picture was taken from a certain position. They move the evidence in certain positions to tighten up the case.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, what Maimonides says is that you are entitled to kill a burglar because you are afraid of being killed yourself. But if you are sure you're not at risk, in particular if the burglar is leaving, then you are not entitled to, and then killing him is murder. So again, that issue was a live issue at least 1,000, maybe 2,000 years ago, which I thought was, again, interesting. Other things that struck people? Yeah.
More sort of overall observation, but it seems like some of an eclectic joinder of topics. Have you read one section, you could go rapidly from giving sour wine to someone to immediately thereafter burial rites, the rules of burial, which seemed very non-connected. I mean, it was almost like,
if you think that's bad, read Mishnah. That is, Maimonides, it seems to me, has on the whole reduced the degree. That's still true. He's reduced the degree to which that's true.
Well, I guess I'm saying about Mishnah.
Oh, about Mishnah. Yeah, no, that's much more true. That's right.
Yeah.
So one of, that is, the changes, I think I may, I'm not sure if I ever read all of Mishnah, but certainly I didn't this time. I just looked at some bits of it that were relevant to Maimonides. But the noticeable changes, one change is that almost always Maimonides gives only one answer. Whereas Mishnah often says such and such, but so and so says such and such, and so and so says such and such. But the other thing is that I think Maimonides tightens it up and organizes it, relatively speaking. That he's pulling together things, some of them are from one chunk, some from another, into something closer to a. Yeah, no, I agree. Mishnah is more that way. But even then, if you think about it, things are connected. So that, for example, one of the ones that you see over and over again is that his view of robbery in particular feels much less morally committed than our view. That he is sort of pooling literal robbery with the person who's been entrusted with something and then loses it, or uses it up himself, or, and well, you know, if you're entrusted with something and you choose to consume it and then claim it was lost, that's pretty much like robbery, but it still doesn't feel quite like robbery. But then what about if, so he's sort of, I mean, did people notice that, that Maimonides is basically treating both theft and robbery as torts, not as crimes? What happens if you've committed robbery? What happens to you as a result of committing robbery? Did people notice? Depends which one you read, but... That's right. Do you get any other punishment? One exception. If you stole an amount that was so small that you don't, less than a peruta, which you sort of think of as a penny, that you don't owe any compensation to the victim, then you get flogged. Sounds crazy, but you can see, this shows up, you may have seen it because it shows up in various places, at least in the volume I was reading, that the basic rule appears to be that you cannot have corporal punishment, you cannot have monetary punishment if there's corporal punishment. So that in one case after another, he says, in effect, here is the, there's a monetary punishment for this. Ah, in this case, there's corporal punishment, so therefore, the monetary punishment that otherwise would have occurred. And that includes tort damages, as far as I can tell. He distinguishes, I should say, for theft, the normal result in theft is that you owe twice the amount stolen. That you give back the property plus a fine of the value of the property. And Maimonides distinguishes that the first half of that is, I don't know what he calls it, but a damage payment. And the second half is a fine. Do you know how you get out of paying a fine? If you're going to have selective punishment for things, what's one very obvious basis on which to decide how large your punishment is? In terms of your action, not in terms of the fact of what you stole. Yep?
Allow the tortfeasor to choose which one he would do.
Specifically, allow somebody to confess. The first chunk of the Book of Torts is about damages by chattels. So that's things like your ox breaking something or goring another ox. The next chunk is theft, and the one after that is robbery. And for theft, the rule, if I understand it, is if you turn yourself in, if you confess rather than having witnesses, you still have to pay the damages, you don't have to pay the fine. And I think that seems to be a pretty general rule. And it's a little confusing because there's a chunk which you see reflected a little in Maimonides, but is explicitly in Mishnah, not explicitly, which is confusingly in Mishnah, about an extra fifth. So that they're talking about a robber having to pay back what he's taken plus an extra fifth. And to begin with, a fifth means a quarter. A fifth means a fifth of the sum with the extra fifth added in. All right, so if you stole 100 whatever, you then pay an extra 25, so 25 is a fifth of 125. And I think, but it's not clear, that that's only if you have sworn an oath that you didn't do it and it wasn't true. So I think that's the punishment for false swearing, really, not the punishment for robbery. Did anybody notice how robbery and theft compare? Which has the higher punishment? What's the difference between robbery and theft? Both
one
in.
One is the open taking, and the other is the
secret taking. That's right. That's. I'm not sure it's quite that clean in modern American law, but in language. But roughly speaking, that's the distinction. So I like when people claim that tax is theft. I like to say no, it's robbery because it's done openly. Question of tax, by the way, comes up in Maimonides too, and it's quite a lot of fun. That you're not supposed to accept. You're not supposed to buy anything from somebody whose property is all presumed to be stolen, such as a brigand or a tax collector. And now he qualifies that later. He actually thinks that some taxes are all right, but I just thought it was a great line. But the basic... Sorry, now I've gotten myself distracted.
You're trying to figure out, you're trying to explain the difference.
Right, theft and robbery. Right. And robbery is open taking, basically, typically by force, and theft is secret taking. And as we will see when we get to Iceland, it's a big distinction for the Icelanders. There's a story which I don't think I'll go into today, but from one of the sagas, where somebody basically objects to the fact that he and his friends are stealing something. And so he goes back, announces to the victims that they've taken it, and then kills a considerable number of the victims in the process because he wants to be an honest man, a robber, rather than a dishonest man, a thief. And in general, in Icelandic law, their distinction between murder and killing is that murder is secret killing. And killing is not shameful, and murder is. And similarly, robbery, after all, some of them spent part of their youth as Vikings. That's sort of what you do if you're growing up. You don't go away to college, you go off Viking. So robbery is not shameful. It may have legal consequences, but it's not shameful. Theft is shameful. And that shows up in the sagas in lots of ways. So it's lots of society make things. But the odd thing about maybe it's not so odd in that light, because of course the Norse prefer robbery to theft, as it were. So does Maimonides, presumably so does Mishnah, that the punishment for theft is twice, and the punishment for robbery, you got to give it back. Sounds really weird, right? Sounds weird to me.
Well, I thought about that, and it occurred to me that one possible explanation is that we're talking about societies 2,500 years older than ours, and it's possible that when you openly take something in such a communal environment, as an assumption, that oftentimes it was in fact not a taking at all, but instead the legal system interpreted that as you had their permission. You went to their house, you borrowed their broom, 3 days later it comes back. There's no crime committed.
But there is. There's a tort committed in that case. Maimonides, I believe, explicitly says that borrowing without permission does count as robbery. But the sense in which I think you're right is that there's a much blurrier line between what we would think of as robbery and we think of as borrowing, as that example shows. Well, if borrowing without permission counts as robbery, then give it back. Makes perfectly good sense. What's the other reason? Putting aside the sort of extreme case of saying all you have to do is to give it back, what's the reason that we might want a higher penalty for robbery, for theft than for robbery? No law and econ types here? Because theft, arguably, you're much less likely to catch the guy. All right, robbery, we know who took it. We can pursue him, and with luck we can get him. Theft, you know, how will they ever find him? Well, the less likely you are to catch somebody, the higher the penalty you want if you want to deter people, because, in effect, the person who commits the crime is facing a lottery, a certain probability of a certain penalty, only one chance in 100 of being caught. If all he has to do is give it back, that's a great deal. Even if he has to give it back twice, that's a pretty good deal. A 50% chance of getting caught, give it back twice, not worth the trouble. And so forth. So I wondered if one of the things that was going on was the idea that robbery being open, you had a higher chance of getting things back. But there are other things that seem to go the other way, because one of the things that Maimonides says is that if you are robbed by, I should say, one of the distinctions Maimonides makes, and he never really explains it, but it runs through it, is whether or not the owner of some property has given up hope of getting it back. So, for example, I don't know if people read this bit, but suppose you steal something from me and sell it to him. Now we discover it. What are our rights? Did anybody read that bit? Because it's sort of interesting. It's kind of a modern.
It talks about, in terms of, if the original owner is disfavored for its loss, so if you think you're not going to get it back, then the buyer can keep it, as opposed to if you have it.
That's right. If the original owner is despaired of getting it back, you have good title, and she owes me its value. If I am not spared of getting it back, I get the property. I have to pay you what you paid her, and you sue her. So the good faith purchaser, in neither case of those cases, is the good faith purchaser really supposed to lose anything. But the question of who has title to the property shifts according to whether I've abandoned hope. Shows up in other places that lost property. If you find something under circumstances where you can reasonably believe the owner has given up hope of getting it back, for example, it was washed away by a flood and you pulled it out of the river, you're entitled to take it. Whereas under most circumstances, lost property, your obligation is in effect to try to find the owner, to advertise the fact that you found this lost property. Did anybody read that bit? What do you have to do when somebody comes to you and says, yes, you said you found something. You found a cow or a purse or something. It's mine. What do you do? Anybody know? Well, depends which part you read. I mean, there's a whole bunch of unless you read all of Maimonides, there's no reason you would have seen it, but it's there. No one got that. I'm just looking because there's something related to that that I thought was really neat that I was going to read. So let me, here we are. I will find something and then I will be with you in a moment. Uh, the basic answer, and it's the same answer in Islamic law, by the way, which is sort of interesting. There's a lot of, if you read Sharia, there's a lot of stuff that you recognize in Maimonides, because it's either they're coming out of the same tradition, or more likely the Muslim law is lifting from the Jewish law, because of course Muhammad thought he was a Jewish prophet. That's pretty clear. It's just the local Jewish tribes didn't agree with him, which turned out to be unfortunate for them, as it turned out. So what do you, well, think about it for a moment. I found something that's potentially valuable, and this fellow comes to me and says, oh yes, you said you found a cow. I lost a cow. That's my cow. What's the obvious response?
Can you identify the cow?
Can you identify it, meaning
distinctive marks?
Can you tell me something that you wouldn't know about the cow if it wasn't yours? That's what identify means in this context. So I found a purse. Tell me how many coins are in it. I found a package. Was it tied up with a distinctive knot? And all that stuff shows up in the Islamic and shows up in the Jewish law.
Yeah, we're talking, there's lots and lots of very specific details that are in the sources where they're saying, okay, so you found a small collection of loose coins. There's no way you can return that because of no distinctiveness. On the other hand, you found a sheaf of wheat, and there's some distinctiveness to the way in which the sheaf of wheat is tied up, and therefore can be and should be advertised.
Right. And similarly, a single nail you keep. A group of nails, there is the possibility of the owner telling you how many were in the group of nails, and therefore you've got to advertise it. But there is an exception. Who do you think it is who is so trustworthy that when he says it's my cow, you believe him? What set of people would you expect this book to be biased in favor of? This book, what? Close. Scholars. Scholars, you guys. Scholars. Let me read this picture. I thought it was great. For if a scholar comes and says, although I'm unable to give an identification mark on a vessel of this type, I can tell it at sight. The finder must show the article to him. If the scholar recognizes it and says it is mine, the finder must return it. Ah. The above rule applies only to a scholar of repute who never tells an untruth, except to promote peace or about a treatise of the Talmud, a bed, or the house where he is a guest. So why are there these four exceptions so that you still consider a scholar an honest man even if he lied about one of those? Did you read that? Oh, it's me. You know why? Guessing it's not practical in this case because it's, but it's great. Thus, if when studying the treatise Nidah, Menstruum, about women's menstruation, he says that he's studying Nikwau, immersion pools, in order not to be asked questions concerning menstruation, which would be embarrassing. Or having slept in one bed, he says that he slept in another, lest signs of nocturnal emission be found there. Or when staying with Simeon, he says that he's staying with Reuben, in order that people should not annoy his host. Or when making peace between one person and another, he embellishes or conceals the facts in order to make them more friendly to one another. The misrepresentation is permissible. But if witnesses come and testify that he has told an untruth in a matter other than one of these, lost property need not be returned to him merely on the strength of his recognition of the article. There's at least one other place where there's what strikes me as an unreasonable bias in favor of scholars. And this is when he's discussing humiliation. If you injure somebody, there are five different grounds of damages, essentially. Did you get the? No. One of them is humiliation. And it depends a lot on who you are and who you injure. But if I understand it correctly, if you say something negative about a scholar, and I don't think he even says it has to be untrue, although maybe he's assuming that, you owe a large sum in damages, a whole bunch of gold. So I have a feeling that the scholars have had their hand in this legal system for their own benefit. So maybe. One of the other things along similar lines, which isn't quite limited to scholars, and that is that if you beat somebody and he dies, normally you're guilty of murder. But there is an exception. If you beat your son, and the reason you beat him is you were teaching him law, and he, you know, wasn't paying attention and so forth, then the dying just counts as an accident. And similarly, if you are a scholar and you beat one of your students and he dies from it, it counts as an accident. So I thought that was also rather neat. There's a good deal of stuff about beating. For example, the question of when a slave master is guilty for murder for killing a slave. It's clear that a slave owner cannot in general kill his slave. But on the other hand, the slave owner can be his slave. And if the slave, if I remember correctly, and I'd have to check to be sure, if a slave owner beats his slave and the slave dies within 24 hours, that's murder. If the slave dies in more than 24 hours or hours, that's not murder, provided that the slave owner was beating him with the sort of thing you beat slaves with. If you were beating him with a sword, then it's still murder. I think that's right. And part of that is because he's going off a particular passage in Torah which refers to beating somebody with a rod. And so that's assumed to signal what kind of beating it is. But anyway, there are quite extensive things about sort of how you decide whether a killing is or not accidental. And if I hit you, if I was aiming to hit you in the leg with a force that would not kill somebody in the leg, but I accidentally hit you over the heart and it kills you, that's not intentional murder. And if I was aiming to hit an adult with a force that would not kill an adult, but I accidentally hit a child instead and kill him, that's not intentional murder. These things may still be crimes. You'd have to look at more detail. But there, so there's a whole bunch of very, very complicated, detailed stuff, which is much of what strikes me. So other things that struck people in what they read? Yes?
I've been discussing with one of these before, and one of the things that I found interesting about him was his concepts of obligations doctors have on the Sabbath.
That probably was not in these volumes, so that was probably part of the religious discussion. Tell me about the obligations of the Sabbath.
The obligations of doctors is specifically Jewish doctors who are the doctor to the head of state. And he says, well...
Who is probably a heathen.
Who is not Jewish.
Yes, exactly.
The Jewish doctor in general does not have an obligation to a non-Jew on the Sabbath. So if the Jewish doctor has no obligation, even if he's on a boat, and the person next to him falls over, and he can reach, you can pull him out. He's not under obligation to do it.
Does that depend on the person who's falling in being non-Jewish or not?
I believe so, yes.
Right. Because there's a bunch of stuff distinguishing between obligations to fellow Israelites and the heathens.
Right. And then for the head of state, if you're the doctor of the head of state,
yes,
you're not obligated to help the head of state, even if he's deathly ill. But you should, because if you don't, the resentment against Jewish people is so strong that it's really in the best interest of the common good, I guess, that you do.
Yeah. As Maimonides was the physician for the head of state, so it's a real case. But you get a similar pattern. There's a slightly more extreme case, which has to do with when you find something that belongs to a heathen. And when you find something that you believe belongs to an Israelite, then as long as it's the sort of thing that could be identified, you're basically not allowed to, and you don't have reason to think the owner gave up hope, then you're supposed to advertise it and so forth. If you find something that belongs to a heathen, you are supposed to not return it to him. Except if returning it to him will make heathens think well of the Israelites, because they're the honest people, then you're obligated to return it to him.
Right.
So it's the same pattern, basically.
So what's interesting about that is how that plays into Islamic international law when it comes to booty from war, which was a real issue at the beginning of the Islamic community. I'm wondering if that's kind of a Semitic...
So what happens in the rules on booty for war? Obviously, you get to keep it normally.
You're going to have to wait for my paper because there's a discussion. There's actually a debate among the early scholars. It's one of the first issues that really got their attention. So they were really divided on...
Have you read Schacht?
Who?
Schacht.
Schacht.
He's a non-Muslim scholar of Islamic law who... you probably ought to read if you're going to make confident statements about the early history, because he argues that a fair amount of the supposed early history is bogus. And he's taken seriously. That is his view is basically that essentially all hadith are forgeries.
There's a great deal of hostility towards the early sources. I had this as I was reading about Islamic international law from my paper in this class, and I talked to the Arabic instructor professor at San Jose State.
Uh-huh.
He immediately became very agitated when I shared with some of my sources. He's like, you have to be very, very, very careful. There's a big difference between practice and reality.
Yes.
And that there's this over-glorified perception of the past.
Yes.
Involved here. And he was very, very adamant about it. Be sure that you understand that this is not Islamic international law, it's this person's perception.
Yeah, but to begin with, the sort of official, the accepted version among Muslim scholars for a long time is that many hadith are fake.
Yeah.
The Hadith are traditions of what Muhammad did and said, basically, which are taken as evidence of what you should do. And the sort of accepted version, everybody, I think, recognized that because Hadith could be used to win a law case, there's a strong incentive to invent Hadith, and you can see medieval accounts referring to this. And so at some point, fairly early, maybe 1,000 years ago, several highly thought of scholars went through all of the Hadith they could find and tried to filter out so that they like started with 50,000 and ended up with 2,000 or something. They eliminated the bulk of them. It's not they knew they were false, but it's not trustworthy. And those collections, Abu Muslim and I forget who the other one is, since then have been generally regarded as authoritative. But Schacht argued and gave evidence sort of from Islamic history that in many cases the traditions were inconsistent with what we know were done by companions of the Prophet who would have known his practice and so forth. And his argument basically is that all of them appeared in the course of debates when people were trying to defend their view of the law, and it was very useful to have but anyway, if you're going to write on the subject, I believe that if you look at my chapter on Islamic law, that in my references, I reference the book by Schacht, so you can get a hold of the copy. That was sort of the central thing in that particular argument, which is still, I think, a living argument about whether it's right or not. But in any case, there's clearly a lot in common between Jewish law and Islamic law. That comes. I mean, this whole business about advertising things you find is in. It's not. The details are different, but it's in Islamic law as well. Anyway, the stuff about sort of interacting with heathens. There's one chunk in Maimonides. Anybody read the chunk where he's basically, which is sort of, maybe I call it paternalist. It's telling things you shouldn't do because they're dangerous. They might get you hurt. For example, you shouldn't drink water or I think wine that has been left uncovered, because a snake might have drunk from it and poisoned it. Whether there are any snakes which actually poison things by drinking from them, I don't know. That's not the usual procedure at which snakes poison things. But you shouldn't do it because it's dangerous. And he has a number of things. But one of the things has to do with your dealing with heathens. That a woman should not be alone with a heathen because heathens are known to be unreliable in sexual matters. And a man should not be alone with a heathen because he might get himself killed. And you shouldn't leave your animal alone with a heathen. And I'll leave you to think about why that is. And you shouldn't have your hair cut by a heathen. Unless, Maimonides says, you're a sufficiently prominent person so that if he killed you, the word would get out and therefore he'll be afraid to kill you. But there are all sorts of different of sort of oddities of this. For example, on the question of giving up hope, if your property is stolen by an Israelite brigand, you give up hope of recovery. If it is stolen by a heathen brigand, you are not assumed to have given up hope of recovery. Why do you think that is? Because the heathen courts have lower standards of proof than the Israelite courts. And therefore, if it's stolen by a heathen brigand, you have a reasonable chance of getting it back because you won't have to really prove he's guilty. Whereas if it's stolen by an Israelite brigand, since you'll need two witnesses to prove that he really stole it from you, your chances of getting it back are really very poor, so you might as well just bury it. So that's sort of a weird case where you, in one sense, it's an argument in favor of the heathen courts, because after all, the assumptions in the account is really your stuff, but because there's something wrong with them, they have high enough standards of proof, basically. Other things that struck people in their reading? Yes?
So we have another case where the law is the same between the ancient Jewish laws and the Mishnah, where they say, if you steal a date tree and cut it down, you haven't attained title to it. If you've chopped it up into pieces, you still haven't attained title to it. But if you planed it, the planks of wood, you now have title to it. And we actually have the same distinction in American and common property law. You can literally take a tree down from somebody's property, convert it into planks of wood, and now you actually have title to it. It's now something different.
You owe them damages.
Probably.
Yes. No. That's a bunch of these distinctions are whether you get the thing and owe money compensation or whether you lose the thing. And one of the interesting cases, which again is striking because it suggests being a whole lot less angry at robbers than we would expect you to be. And that is that the normal rule when you've when a robber has taken something and has not changed it, is that he's got to give it back. The original rule Maimonides implies is that even if taking it back is very costly, suppose the thing he stole is a rafter and he built it into a building, that the Torah rule, he would say, is that he's got to tear down the building in order to give you back your rafter. But the sages have decreed, out of mercy for people who confess their crimes, essentially, that in that case he can just give you money compensation instead. But there are a whole bunch of things with theft, and I think also robbery. Somebody steals your sheep, and when he steals the sheep is ready to be sheared. It's got a heavy coat of wool. He shears it, sells the wool, he's caught. Not only does he have to compensate you for the sheep, he has to compensate you for the wool. Now, suppose he steals your sheep and it's not heavy with wool. You just sheared it last week. And it's 6 months before you get it back, during which time he takes care of the sheep, he feeds the sheep, and lo and behold, when you get it back with it, it's heavy with wool. What do you think happens? You owe him compensation for the way in which he has improved your property that he stole. All right? And there are a bunch of cases along those general lines where somebody has done something that we would say is unambiguously wrongful, and yet if he has also done you a benefit, he's entitled to credit for that benefit.
Yeah, but that is true in common law property as well. If you are occupying somebody's property illegally, and you improve it,
even if you know that it's his property.
I believe this has to do with when you're attempting to attain adverse possession. So I could be wrong, but so you fail in your attempt to adverse
yes.
possess the property. But you made improvements. You're owed for the improvements you made on that property. I believe. I don't believe that.
That's interesting. I don't know that.
Simply take yes. it all back and say, thank you for building this nice shed. Plowing the fields and taking yep. up all the trees. I don't know you would die for all that.
Yep. Yes, well, the Jewish law, very clearly, there are a bunch of cases along those general lines, and there are complications as to what you owe, whether you owe him for what he spent on it, or whether you owed it for the improvement of the value, and in some cases you owe for the lesser of those two, and so forth. But it's clear that the presumption is that if someone has wrongful possession of your property and improves it, he's entitled to a compensation for that improvement. I thought that was quite interesting. But as I say, as far as I can tell, with the sole exception of robbing something which is too small an amount for damages, there is never a punishment for theft or robbery other than the obligation to return the property. I don't know, maybe if you imagine the sort of the situation of a fraternity or a sorority where everything belongs to somebody but people don't pay much attention to it. You say, well, look, what happened to my textbook? Oh, I'm sorry. We were having an exam yesterday, and so I took it off your shelf and was studying in it. I'll bring it back. So one wonders if maybe some of what this is coming out of is some situation like that where there's a much... Where yes, robbery could be literal robbery. Clearly, some of these cases are literal robbery. And yet, where he wants the legal category to cover everything from that to a sort of a casual misappropriation, which is what it seems to be doing. So, anyway, lots of interesting stuff there. Other things that struck people in what they read? Yes?
I was interested in the way that, certainly in the chattels section.
Yep. Injuries by chattels, you mean.
Right.
Yep.
Maimonides had a willingness to invent hypotheticals out of very simple phrases found in the Mishnah.
Yes.
I don't remember what the phrase was that the Mishnah had, but it had something to do with if a rooster were to damage property or something like that. So Maimonides took that to mean if a rooster were to stick its head in a glass jar and then make a noise loud enough to break the glass jar, the
yes.
spices contained in it. It was
yes.
such a completely ridiculous, like,
let me see if I can find this. This has a index. It may or may not be detailed enough to have a rooster in it. It does not. But yes.
I'm wondering where he gets, because you talk about the way, and I see the way Talmud and Mishnah, he's trying to just elaborate upon the. Where do you get the ideas that you're born? Where might...
Well, of course, he may have he may be getting that from Talmud. Mm-hmm. It's possible that someone in Talmud, where they're routinely elaborating on things, gave that example. He's then lifting it for that. Remember, he's post Talmud by quite a long chunk. So the answer is that we could check, because if you've got the same edition of the Book of Torah that I do, it does in the introduction tell you which part of that comes from where in the Mishnah. So, but anyway, I guess you saw it from what you said. So you don't remember where in Mishnah that was? Yes. Which book was it? Do you remember? Just curious whether I can find it. Yes. Baba Kama. That's in the fourth division. The order of damage is Baba Kama. That's what a good deal.
I think it was either in chapter 2 or 10.
Just a minute. I will see if I can find your rooster. Chapter 2, how is the leg deemed an attested danger? How is the tooth deemed an attested danger? The dog or the goat which jumped from the top of the roof, he discusses that, and that's in Maimonides. What is a harmless animal? An ox which causes damage in the domain of one who is injured, as opposed to one in his own domain. Man is perpetually an attested danger. What's the exception? I don't know if it's in here, but in Maimonides, when am I allowed to roll over on you and injure you or break your property and I'm not liable? No, that's a good guess, but I don't think he actually says that. No, that was not sufficient. If you lay down by me after I fell asleep, if two men lie down next to each other and fall asleep, and one of them rolls over on the other and injures him, he's liable. But if I was asleep when you lay down next to me, I didn't know you were there, so I'm not liable. It's true. It's in Maimonides. I could show you the chapter and verse, so to speak.
I believe it was. It had to do with the section where it's talking about if an animal were to consume the fruits or vegetables of someone else, and then if an animal were to destroy the retaining vessel of a property.
So far, I'm following on ox. You don't remember which chapter, because I went through 2 and 3.
Right now, it's like page 7.
Yeah, well, that's not the version I'm looking at. But it's in it's in chapter 2 of Baba Kama. Mm-hmm. Let me see, because that's a reasonable place for it to be, but I haven't found it yet. Here's the dog, which took a cake to which a cinder adhered, and went to standing grain, ate the cake, and set the sack on fire. For the cake, the owner pays full damages, but for the standing grain, he pays for only half of the damages. You can't really expect a dog to set fire to the grain, so therefore he wasn't negligent, so therefore he pays half damages. Wait a minute, there's a fowl that. Fowl or an attested damage, if a fowl has its feet entangled. I still haven't found the rooster, I found a fowl. So let's get it. But you see it in the Mishnah too. I mean, in some of these cases, they're giving quite detailed things where presumably intended as examples, and it sounds as though a lot of this in both Maimonides and examples, he goes through something detailed, and in all similar cases, the same rule applies. So it's he's trying to. Yes?
So we have this. This interesting argument about when a contract becomes valid, and they have this incredible case, this is from the Mishnah, when the argument is if two people agree on something, but one person has not lifted up or pulled towards him the object in question, then the contract is not valid. And if you exchange money in exchange for it, the contract is still not valid under certain circumstances. And they go into this incredible convoluted argument where if I give you gold or silver, that would be a valid exchange, and the contract is valid, because gold is never exchanged for silver as it is, as money, it's always done for some other purpose. But the idea, I mean, in the UCC, we have the idea if the contract is for less than $500, then it can be valid, even if it's purely oral. But here, it's not valid until one party has literally lifted up the object at least X height, or has pulled it towards him. Otherwise, even though I've exchanged gold, I can still say, no, I'm not calling.
Except for land. Land has different rules. It's sort of hard to pick up land.
Yes.
Portable
goods.
To give an adequate discussion of this, I would have to go back to the sources and reread them, because there's this elaborate series of stuff where you get rules, I think, in rabbinic law which make selling stuff hard. And in particular, it's hard either to contract for something that doesn't exist yet, or, as in your case, to contract for something which isn't physically present. And then there were a bunch of legal devices created. They may well be post-Mishnah to solve this problem. So that one of them is that you hand somebody a handkerchief, and that's the object. And now the other half that you're supposed to be exchanging now is yours. Of course, you're also going to pay him money, but the money wouldn't have done it for some reason, and the handkerchief would. And I think, if I remember correctly, this is post-Torah. I think Torah, if I remember correctly, the money does give you ownership, but the rabbinic law, it doesn't. Mishnah is post-Torah, of course. And then there's another neat scheme, and that is that if I transfer land to you, I am also transferring the stuff connected with the land. And connected with apparently doesn't have to mean physically on it. It's not clear what it means. And therefore, if I want to sell you some goods in a caravan 300 miles from here, what I do is to say, well, those goods are associated with this piece of land, and I'm selling you the piece of land and everything associated with it. And thus you can get the ownership without having to lift it. Now, what if I don't have any land to sell you? Not a problem. Every Jew is entitled to a per capita share of the land of Israel. So I can sell you my share of the land of Israel along with my caravan stuff. But again, I'd have to go back to Malachi Milan's book. If you're curious, I think I did put it on reserve. And that's a detailed modern secondary source account of this. But he describes the various methods that were worked out at different stages. So that if the previous generation's law made it really hard to do something, here is how we think up a legal device to do it. And as that goes into a lot of detail. So what things, if theft and robbery are not crimes, or are mostly not crimes, or treated as torts, what things are crimes? What are the things you can get flogged or executed for, but not fined for? Anybody know? Well, the obvious one is murder. All right. Explicitly, the apparently Torah forbids you to accept monetary compensation for murder. The Icelanders would never stand for that attitude, but that's at least the attitude here. And notice that implies, as several other things imply, that this is being built, as it were, on the ruins of a fossilized feud system, because you don't tell people not to do something unless you expect they might do it. And so the implication is that pre the handing down of the Old Testament, you know, to Moses from God and all that stuff, people did sometimes accept a sort of standard monetary compensation for killing. And what else? Well, what other sorts of things would you guess are treated as crimes that cannot be made up by giving anybody money? What's the obvious in this society category of such things? Who could you act against? Who could you be guilty towards other than another human being?
God,
of course, all you silly moderns. God, he's up there. You can all sorts of things you can do which are offenses against God. Some of them are capital offenses against God. You're not supposed to work on the Sabbath. You're not supposed to hold. Again, I haven't read those volumes, so I can't give you a detailed account to keep you safe. But it's clear, reading Maimonides, that you can be executed for breaking some of the religious laws. And in fact, if one of the questions he discusses, if you're doing something which is both a tort and a violation of the religious law, do you owe tort damages? And he has one case where you do, but he explains that's because there are two different things. You first, I forget what it was, you first stole the cow and then committed some religious offense with the cow. I don't remember what it was anymore. Not what you may or may not be thinking of, but more things like you slaughtered it on the Sabbath or something. I don't remember what it was, but you did something wrong with it. And in that case, you both get executed and you owe a fine because they were two separate things. But if you do an action which is simultaneously a religious and a civil offense, as it were, you get out of the fine because you're going to get flogged or executed or whatever for it. I thought that was really rather neat. Incidentally, at least some of the stuff on the requirements for executing a disobedient son is in the Constitution. I don't think it has the full list that I got out of Maimonides, but it has parts of that which sound bizarre. Other things. With regard, I don't count exactly as a crime, but with regard to theft and I think robbery as well, in addition to repaying the victim, you're supposed to get him to forgive you. And as far as I can tell, there is no legal sanction requiring you to get him to forgive you, but there is a moral sanction. You're a bad person if you haven't. But on the other hand, he has a moral obligation to forgive you once you've admitted your offense and given it back. And that was, there are a fair number, there seem to be, it's a little clear what the different categories of obligation are, because there are some things where it seems pretty clear that you're supposed to do it, but there's no legal sanction for not doing it. So that, for example, I think he says that if somebody is running after someone else to kill him, and you kill the pursuer when you could have just injured him, that there is no legal penalty, but you're deserving of death. I think that's how he puts it. And another case is if you commit murder indirectly. He goes in, did anybody read that thing? Because he goes into some detail on the case in which you kill somebody by hiring someone else to kill him. Or by, he gives a bunch of different ways in which you aren't literally killing himself, but in any ordinary sense you're responsible. And what happens in those cases? Didn't read it. All right. Well, to begin with, in those cases, we can't, under sort of the high-level Torah law, we can't execute you because you didn't literally kill him, and which I assume means that whatever the relevant phrase in the Old Testament seems to apply directly. On the other hand, the court could kill him if it's necessary, sort of as a special precaution to avoid more bad things happening kind of thing. And if there's a king around, the king could kill him. There's various stuff suggesting the king has power beyond what the religious law gives. But suppose that there's no king around, and suppose that the court can't claim for special reason you have to kill him. Let me find the passage, because it's a great passage. Here we are. It's a section of the Book of Torts, and it is chapter 2, paragraph 2 and 3. Let's find that. Murder and the Preservation of Life, chapter 2. Here we are. Regarding, however, if one hires an assassin to kill another, or sends his slaves to kill him, or ties another up and leaves him in front of a lion or another animal, and the animal kills him, I assume all those count as murder in the first degree in U.S. law, no? Yes? You're saying nobody ever bothers to tie somebody up in front of a lion or the lion kill him? And similarly, if one commits suicide, all right, the rule in each of these cases is that he is a shedder of blood, has committed the crime of murder, and is liable for death at the hand of heaven. A little hard for the suicide case, but there is no capital punishment at the hands of the court. How do we know that this is the rule? Because Scripture says, "Whoso sheddeth man's blood by man shall his blood be shed," referring to one who commits the murder himself and not through an agent. And so forth.
What about the physical situation of attempting suicide?
Don't know. You could look it up. Regarding any of these or similar murderers who are not subject to being condemned to die by verdict of the court, if a king of Israel wishes to put them to death by royal decree for the benefit of society, he has a right to do so. There are, of course, any kings of Israel, but that's all. Similarly, if the court deems it proper to put them to death as an emergency measure, it has the authority to do as it deems fit, provided the circumstances warrant such action. If the king does not kill them, and the needs of the time do not demand their death as a preventive measure, it is nevertheless the duty of the court to flog them almost to the point of death, to imprison them in a fortress or a prison for many years, and to inflict severe punishment on them in order to frighten and terrify other wicked persons, lest such a case become a pitfall and a snare, enticing ones to say, "I will arrange to kill my enemy in a roundabout way as did so-and-so, then I will be acquitted." So, deterrence, interesting. Yes?
What is the relationship of the text for today and the law of the current state of Israel?
That's a good question. Israel is not under Jewish law, is the answer. That Israeli law is a modern secular law, which I believe in various ways is modified, sort of affected by Jewish law. But it is not the case that Jewish law currently prevails in Israel, although I am sure there are Israelis who think it should.
That seems probable to me. Do you know in what way they're related?
What the difference? I don't. That is, I'm reasonably sure, for example, that you do not require two witnesses in order to convict someone of murder. You don't have to have two witnesses who will say before he committed the murder, I said to him, by the way, murder is a capital offense, you really don't want to do this, and he said, to hell with it, and did it. Which, roughly speaking, is the sort of base requirement with all sorts of exceptions as suggested by this, but the base requirement under Jewish law. My impression is, I'm not sure, but I think things like marriage law are much more heavily affected by Jewish law than ordinary civil law. And I'm pretty sure if you rob in Israel, you don't get to say, all right, I'll give it back to you, and that's it, and I go home free. But Ilan's book is four volumes, and I didn't read the fourth volume, because the fourth volume was about the law of the state of Israel, and that's not of any great interest to me. But if curious enough, I think I put all four volumes on reserve, because the fourth volume has the index, which makes it very useful. And, you know, the somebody's line about the odd characteristics of German. So, you know, how did you like that German novel? I don't know. The last three pages were missing, and they had all the verbs. Anybody who studied German will understand this. But similarly, with the fourth volume, which everything didn't take out, missing, it's hard to find stuff. But so he makes it clear that it doesn't apply. But I can't tell you in any great detail. One of the things which was clear reading Elan is that from the standpoint of Jewish law, what kills it is toleration. That what kills it is the emancipation. That basically up to the late 18th century, it sounds as though most Jews were living under Jewish law because the non-Jewish rulers had a deal with the Jewish community basically with whether you can enforce your law on your own people. And then, starting the late 18th century in Europe, you got this bizarre modern idea that Jews are people just like everybody else, and in particular, Jews in France are not Jews who are in France, they're Frenchmen who happen to be Jews. Well, if they're Frenchmen who happen to be Jews, they're under the same law as all the other Frenchmen, and then you cease having a self-ruling community. And Elan doesn't quite describe this as a catastrophe, but that sort of is the tone of his comments. And it's, you know, normally think of emancipation as a good thing, and in many ways, no doubt it was. But if you think of Jewish law itself as a good thing, then you can see why it's a problem. One of the things which I'm still not sure I fully understand, I think I may have mentioned in the chapter, that seemed odd, is the idea that not only can you punish an informer, you can get the Kievan authorities, the Gentile authorities, to punish him for you, even though one of the things informers do is to tell the Gentile authorities where you got your money hidden and stuff. And that actually comes up in Maimonides, and he gives a little more detail. Let me find it. Here we are. 5:48 is where that is. Because he describes informers and he also gives some qualifications. Oops. I thought that was 5:48 I said. Nope, that's wrong. I don't have just a minute. Maybe it's the one before it. Maybe it's 4:4. That's 4:8. It's Wounding and Damaging, Chapter 8, Chapter 6, Chapter 7, Chapter 8. If one acting as an informer delivers another property into the hands of a villainous person, he must pay compensation for his best property. Whether the villainous person is a heathen or an Israelite, the informer must pay for whatever the villainous person takes, even if the former does not take the money with his own hand and surrender, but merely supplies information. And he then goes through coerced. If they force you to do it, maybe it's all right. Thus, if a king decrees that wine or fodder or the like must be brought to him, and an informer comes forward and says that a certain person has a store of wine or fodder in a specified place, and the king's men go and take it, he must pay compensation. But again, it doesn't apply if the king forces him to tell, basically. And they then go through, he goes through lots and lots of details about it. An informer may be killed anywhere, even at the present time when we do not try cases involving capital punishment, and it is permissible to kill him before he is informed. As soon as one says that he is about to inform against so-and-so's person or property, even a trivial amount of property, he surrenders himself to death. He must be warned and told, do not inform. And then if he is impudent and replies, not so, I shall inform against so-and-so, it is a religious duty to kill him. And he who hastens to kill him acquires merit. If the informer has carried out his intention and given information, it is my opinion, and this is a qualification which only very occasionally makes, it is my opinion that we are not allowed to kill him unless he is a confirmed informer, in which case he must be killed lest he inform against others. There are frequently cases in the cities of the Maghreb where informers who are known to reveal people's money are killed or are handed over to the heathen authorities to be executed, beaten, or imprisoned as befits their crime. Now, what isn't clear to me is whether the ones who get the heathen informers to, the heathen authorities to deal with, are ones who have done their informing to the heathen authorities, or whether they're the ones who inform to a brigand or a bandit, and the heathen authorities disapprove of that too. So, but that's sort of one little bit on this, what seemed to be a very puzzling bit of the idea of the Gentile authorities enforcing rules against towing Gentile authority stuff, which is what Elon seemed to be describing. Are there things that struck people in what they read? Another issue which I didn't mention, which comes up, and which I don't know if it comes up in any modern law or not, it might, is the question of whether the thief was a notorious thief. This again goes to the question of the third party. After she steals from me and sells it to you, if she was a notorious thief, we all know that she lives by stealing, then you should have assumed it was stolen property, and tough luck, you give it back to me, and if you want your money back, you go sue her. And I assume that in all of this, the critical thing is the thief may well not have anything to pay with when you sue. One of the issues that arises is the limits of your ability to recover stuff. So that, for example, suppose that you steal from me and I can prove it with two witnesses, but you consumed what you stole and you don't have anything. What recourse do I have? This is not a modern society. Goes one step farther. I sell him into slavery. However, I can only do that for the compensation and not for the fun. Right? So, if you stole something worth 50 from me, you consumed it, if you can pay me back 50, now you still owe me another 50, but I can't sell you in order to get it. Indeed, if you can't pay me back anything and I sell you, the second 50 is an obligation that you have to pay after you cease being a slave. And there are other contexts where this kind of issue comes up. There's a bit of, let me see if I can find it, about the people who it's dangerous to attack. Do I have that? I don't have a note on it. But basically, that it's dangerous to attack. It includes women. It may include slaves. Basically, because they are people who, if you injure them, you owe damages. If they injure you, they owe a damage but have no resources of their own to pay it with. So if a slave injures you, I'd have to check, but I think it's the case that if a slave injures you, I don't think his master is obligated to pay, because at least the point is made in a different context, that the slave commits a tort, his master isn't obligated, because otherwise the slave who was mad at his master could do huge amounts of damage and get his master into a lot of trouble. That's explicitly in Maimonides. And I think the rule is that a married woman, I think if you fight with a married woman and she injures you, I believe that neither she nor her husband is obliged to compensate you until her husband dies or she gets divorced, at which point she's now a free agent, as it were, has resources of her own, has to compensate you. And I think the same rule applies to a slave when he gets freed. Until he's freed, he doesn't know it. But he has the debt and he carries it forward. And there's an implication that a good deal of the slaves are going to be freed, because I think the rule was that every seventh year, I think, you're supposed to free slaves. I think that goes along with, there's this whole bunch of stuff that every seventh year you're supposed to forgive debts. And that's a real pain, because of course nobody will lend you in the sixth year. And the God writing the Old Testament recognized this problem, because he explicitly says, don't be selfish and refuse to lend people in the sixth year, because you know you're not going to get back. Be generous and help your fellow man. But someone, possibly Hillel, had a more realistic view of the subject than God, and so they eventually invented a legal formula called a prosbul, in which I could lend you money specifically under rules which said, even after the seventh year, you still got to return. So that was sort of an interesting bit of it. Going back to obligations to heathens, which was also sort of interesting, that suppose you're having a transaction with a heathen and you see he's made a mistake in your favor. So that he's bought your cow for 5 pieces of silver, but he's carelessly counted out 6. You can't just complete the transaction without doing anything. That would be dishonest. But you can say to him something along the lines of, I don't know if you have the right amount of money or that, money there or not, but I'll accept your account. That's not the exact formula, but my mind is in the type of. And now you're entitled to take the overpayment, even though you know it's an overpayment. So that was, I thought, a sort of an interesting distinction that he's making. Well, I wanted to get back to taxes, because I did think it was sort of interesting, the whole issue there are a bunch of issues having to do with conflicting claims. So that, for example, if you manage to get lost in somebody's vineyard, you're allowed to cut your way out, even though that presumably will do some damage. I think the assumption is that vineyards are really almost like a jungle with all the vines. And furthermore, if you've got to have a bowel movement when you're on the public road, you're allowed to trespass off the public road, behind the fence, and then come back. And even if you're on the public road and it's got so wet and slippery that it's dangerous to travel in, you're allowed to go off the public road onto the private path that you otherwise wouldn't be allowed to go onto. And on the other hand, if you have property next to the public road, you aren't allowed to build a balcony out over the public road if it would be to any degree a nuisance. They go into details. You're certainly not allowed to do it if a loaded camel or something might bump into it, but I think there's even further restriction. What you can do is to withdraw your boundary back and then build the balcony out over what was your property. But you can't then move your fence back out again once you've opened up that land to the public. It's the public's, except that you can have a balcony over it because it used to be your land. I thought that was sort of an intrigued bit. The business of forewarned animals I was mentioning earlier, it's quite interesting, because basically the rule is that an ox is not forewarned against things you wouldn't expect it to do. The general rule really is that forewarned, it's close to our idea of negligence, not exactly the same thing. That an ox, which has several times gored other oxes, the ox and the owner knows it's dangerous, and therefore he is responsible if it gores an ox. An ordinary ox, however, you don't expect it to injure another ox, so if it does, you have a lesser obligation. Did people read that? Can you tell me, what's my obligation if my unforewarned ox gores your ox? Half damages limited to the value of my ox. Half damages from the body of my ox. And again, I think that's coming from some phrase in Torah. On the other hand, if my ox has gored 3 oxen before, now I'm forewarned that I owe you full damages from the best of my land, my own assets. But then you get these weird, complicated cases, which it's hard to take seriously, about what makes it forewarned. And it looks as though if it's gored 3 camels, it's still not forewarned against an ox. Against goring an ox. And if it's gored 3 oxen, it's still not forewarned, I think, against a camel. And there's even the bizarre idea that if it is only gored on a Sabbath, it's not forewarned against goring not on a Sabbath. How the ox knows when it's the Sabbath, God only knows, but I don't know. But there are these, and again, it looks to, I don't believe Maimonides believes this part. I think he's just repeating what he's got to say because it's probably in Mishnah or somewhere. But you can see that in principle there's a problem. That's what pattern of behavior predicts on future pattern of behavior. So the ox is always forewarned with regard to eating stuff because we know that oxen routinely, if something good to eat, they'll eat it. And he's always forewarned with regard to stepping on things, because we know that oxen go around stepping. They don't look to make sure whether they're going to damage something. So therefore, if it eats or steps on something on someone else's private property, you're basically liable for the whole loss. And it gets more complicated if it's in the public way, then I think you're liable only to the extent that the ox is benefited by way of took it, and you owe the benefit. You shouldn't be on debt. Shouldn't have unjust enrichment via your ox, basically. But anyway, I thought that was sort of neat. One of the other things that I thought was interesting is this whole discussion of liability, and I was wondering how well it did or didn't parallel our rules. Because anybody remember what the five different, when I injure you, what are the five different things I may be liable for? What five different ways have I injured you if I wound you or something? This is the wounding section of it. What would you guess are the obvious ones? What's the first obvious thing that I'm liable for if I wanted to do it? What this is how we calculate the damages they owe you?
Pain and suffering.
I wouldn't know that the first, but yes. Pain and suffering is one of them. That's in his list of five. What else? Damage meaning to compensate me for the ways in which I'm in the worse condition after being injured than before. And how do we calculate that? What? Or how to, either way, how does Maimonides calculate it? He's got a much better way than we do, but.
Yeah, I don't.
Is this the one that is half the value of the person if you have two of them?
Oh, that exists for some things. But the normal rule, that's a much clearer rule actually in Islamic law. But no, the standard rule is to say, if I were a slave, how much would my market value be decreased by this injury? All right? So that's the injury. That's two. We've got pain and suffering, and the long-term effect of my injury. What are the other costs that you have put on me?
Lost wages.
The cost of idleness is, I think, the way he puts it. And that's a little tricky. And if I correctly understand this discussion, in the ordinary case, it's what I have what I would have to be paid to be willing to be idle in my normal profession. And that's an odd way of putting it, but of course, strictly speaking, that's better than lost wages because people value leisure. So you might say, I make $150 a day, but if you pay me $40 a day, I'd be willing to take the day off because, you know, I could go to the basketball game or whatever. And I think he puts it in that way. But the exception, if I understand him correctly, is if you have crippled me in such a way that I couldn't ordinarily do my normal profession. The crippling, I get damages for, reflecting that. But now the lost wages are for the kind of job I could do given that I'm crippled in that way. He doesn't put it that way. He puts it in terms of a cucumber watchman for one kind of crippling and a door guard, I think, for another. But my guess of what's going on, and I might be wrong, I haven't looked at what Mishnah says, is that the idea is that even if you're one-handed, you can be a watchman. And even if you're one-footed, you can stand at the door letting people in or something. Or maybe you sit at the door and let people in if you're one-footed. But it's pretty clear that in the case where you've done a crippling injury, that, I think, decreases the lost time thing because you've already paid him for the injury, and given the injury, you couldn't have done that much with his time anyway. So we've got three categories. We've got pain and suffering, we've got injury, and we've got lost time. What are the others?
Possibly the out-of-pocket cost of getting
medical expenses. That's right. Medical expenses is an interesting question. Modern question, too. Modern when it covers both medical expenses and lost time. I injure you. We don't know how long you're going to be incapacitated, how long you'll be in the hospital, what you'll need. So how do we calculate what I owe you? Anybody know what is the rule now? There are two obvious alternatives. One of them is that somehow the court estimates what on average the amount will be, and I pay you that. And the alternative is we wait and see, and I've got to pay the bills as they come in. Anybody know what usually happens in U.S. law? Because I don't.
Lump sum payment initially.
What?
So lump sum payment. Lump sum payment. You have to guess what the costs are.
Can you see the disadvantages of both of those? Aside from the question of who is insuring the uncertainty, because that's not really a disadvantage, it's just a transfer, whether it's the
tortfeasor or the victim who takes the uncertainty. But what's the obvious disadvantage of the lump sum system, especially for lost wages, more for lost wages than for medical costs?
Inaccuracy.
What particular form of inaccuracy?
Underpayment. Or maybe overpayment, I guess.
We tell the following story. The trial ends, and the person who claims will never walk again has gotten a large damage payment. And the lawyer for the other party says, you know and I know that this is a fraud, that you are pretending to be much more seriously. I lost the case, I can't stop that, but I'm going to watch you. And if we ever see you walking again, you're back in court. And the plaintiff says, well, I don't want to put you in any extra trouble. So to make it easier for you to watch me, let me show you my immediate plans. This is the ticket that I bought to go to Lourdes. People do or don't know what Lourdes is? It's a place where they're supposed to be miraculous healed. Cured. Okay. So he's going to go to Lourdes and he's going to walk again. So one of the disadvantages of the lump sum is that it reduces, it makes fraud easier, because you don't have to continue the fraud once you've gotten paid. But there are obviously, the other way, you could say, but look, if I'm being paid by the week, as it were, then why should I go to a lot of trouble to try to get myself back into shape and get the job again when I can just keep getting paid by that? So they both have disadvantages. Anyway, Maimonides' answer, we're running out of time anyway, Maimonides' answer is that as a concession for the benefit of the tortfeasor, he's allowed to pay a lump sum. But since it's a concession for the benefit of the tortfeasor, he has the option, if he prefers, of paying the medical expenses as they actually turn out. He doesn't, however, get to provide his own doctor, presumably because he might provide a doctor who wasn't very good and was cheap.
What's the last one? That's my four.
You're right. Any guess? The fifth one I don't think we have is humiliation. And it's not clear. Some of that seems to involve exposure, because he talks about cases where you bump into somebody and somehow you lift his clothes so that presumably some part of him that's not supposed to be public view goes to public view. But it isn't just that, because that's also included in the bit about insulting a scholar, that's humiliation. And humiliation depends partly on the status of the person who's humiliated and partly on the status of the person who is humiliated by, but humiliation is in fact a different category. And he then goes into details on all sorts of different circumstances in which you may not owe all of them. There are some circumstances in which you owe all five. That's sort of the clearest case of a deliberate injury and so forth. Others in which you owe four, three, and so forth. Anyway, we're out of time. So I hope people, and I know that although it was a good deal of work going through it, I enjoyed reading Maimonides. I think it's